me is that even though I have this powerful weapon, and even if you fall asleep, my talk will not turn violent. So, and I also need to clarify that by expansion, it's not going to be related to expanders. So if you are looking for expanders, sorry, I don't have anything to offer. So the motivation of my talk is this big question. Is quantum communication indeed more powerful than classical communication? And an equivalent way of saying the question is, are we wasting our time studying quantum computation? So I'm taking an incrementalist approach. We hope to identify the largest classes of quantum computation that can be efficiently assimilated. And this English verb is a translation of some Dutch word that we cannot spell. At least I'm not giving you a Chinese version of it. So the advantage of this approach is if the answer is no, quantum is not useful, then we are on a right track to prove the correct result at the end. And if the answer is yes, we by doing this, we also know better what are this non-simulatable quantum computation must be like. So for according to my knowledge, I know many of you work on this area, so correct me or comment if I miss anything. We know a few kind of line intersecting classes of quantum computation that we know how to simulate. We have Gottesman and Niels result saying that quantum circuits, when they use very restricted gate sets, then it may be easy to simulate. And we have quite a few quantum computation frameworks that can be simulated because we can reduce the simulation to this Fisher, Kastet, Lin, and Temple A algorithm for counting perfect matchings of the planar graph. So I'm listing some publications I know, and dot 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 means that your paper belongs to dot dot. If you don't see your name appear, it's no offense. And there's also a line of research showing that if the quantum circuit creates very small entanglement, then it's easy to simulate. And there are a few papers showing that if the quantum circuit or one-way computation, the source state you start with, has small width parameter, then it's easy to simulate. So what I'm going to talk about belongs to this class. So let me start with a sleeping pill for you, like a pretty sleep. So quantum circuit, they describe is a way to describe algorithms. So you start with quantum wires, and each wire represents one qubit, and you apply gates to those wires, and at the end, you are going to do some measurement on the computation basis. So we assume that you start with product states. So in this talk, I'm going to assume that every gate is a simple operator. I think about the input and output as operators. So that when I measure a qubit, then the others, I can say I'm chasing out the other qubits. So that's the circuit model. And what is one-way quantum computation? I would argue that one-way quantum computation is a method of doing quantum computation so that our distinguished US citizen Homo sensum knows how to do quantum computation. If you ask Homo to do quantum computation based on quantum circuit, it may be very dangerous. Homo doesn't know how to deal with the quantum objects, manipulated quantum objects. So instead, we are going to outsource the more dangerous, more difficult task in quantum computation to some some factory that will produce quantum bits flowing through in a stream in front of Homer, and Homer would just press button doing single qubit measurement. Okay, the advantage of one-way computation is there exist such a stream of quantum bits in a quantum state, very special quantum state, such that even Homer can do any quantum computation by pressing buttons, doing single qubit measurement, and it's adaptive single qubit measurement. So one-way quantum computation is quantum computation for everyone.
Yes. right. Yeah. I'm also saying the typical part to the creation of this thing. Yeah. So now the key question now, Homer is going to take care of the button pressing task. So the default task now seems to me is what kind of state you can send Homer so that he can do arbitrary quantum computation.
So in this work by Brigel and Rosendorf, this groundbreaking work, so they show that some states called graph states, some type of graph states, can be used to do universal quantum computation. And I'm going to write down. I know you defined graph states using stabilizers, so I'm going to give you an algorithmic definition of graph states. Given a graph G, so the graph state G is simply this. Every vertex, there is a qubit sitting there, and so we start with all zero of those qubits, and then we apply Hadamard on every qubit, and then we're going to apply control phase flip on pairs of the qubits, and whenever there's an edge in a graph, then I will apply a control phase flip. So it's 1-1, and I change the phase. Otherwise, I do not change the phase. So this is control phase flip. So we have this simple circuit that computes a graph state, that operates a graph state from all zero state. So Rosendorf and Brigel show that the graph state for grid is universal. So starting with a sufficiently large grid state, you can simulate any quantum computation of about the same size. An important question that I believe has not been solved is, so what kind of states are universal? It's hard to, I think it's probably no consensus on how to define universality. Because if you're not careful in defining a state being universal, you may make a problem which states are universal. The question become more difficult than whether or not a quantum computation is useful. Okay. So instead of defining what is universal, I'm going to define what is simulatable. So a set of a family of states, Sn, and each one of them is a n-qubit quantum state. I call it simulatable if for any one-way computation on the state Sn, there exists a polynomial in n time randomized algorithm that outputs an identical distribution as the measurement outcomes of the one-way computation. So that's my definition, and you may have your own definition, but I'm going to stick with that. So the main message of today, informally speaking, is that if a graph is like a tree, then the graph state is simulatable.
Some epsilon, say, in that definition that you want to get?
Epsilon would be a relaxed definition, but So if you, so if something is simulable in this sense, then it's
sure.
just for your.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I guess, well, okay, yeah.
In principle, you can define that notion, but let's start with.
Yeah, you have a more powerful result.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay, so in my field, that this has been known, and it's my fault to give that impression, because in 2005, we thought like we had a result like that, and we claim that. But it turns out that the proof didn't show exactly that conclusion. And so finally, we fixed the bug. And so what I'm showing you is the correct proof for a result that you failed that is, has been known for months. So if you would feel happy enough to feel confident that the result is true and talk about proof, then you don't need to listen to me.
Maybe you were happy then, now.
So then I'm trying to make you happy again.
Yeah.
So the result will, the simulation will be formulated in the framework of tensor contraction. And so this is your second sleeping pill. So let me start that with what is a tensor. A tensor is nothing but a multi-dimensional array in computer science terminology. So a rank K tensor in a M dimension space, I can represent it as a octopus, is this star that has K levels. And each level can take a value from N distinct values. And for each combination of those values, there is a complex logarithm. Okay, so this is a M to the K dimensional array of complex numbers. So there are variants of tensors called matrix product states and projected entangled paired states, maybe also some other Dutch or Chinese variants. Okay, so if you have two tensors, we can connect the wires together and use the same level for these connected wires. And by doing this, we can apply an operation of tensor contraction. So what it does is the tensor contraction is basically a generalization of matrix multiplication. And I'm going to remove the wires that both tensors share. And that give me a new tensor whose wires are the surviving wires from the previous two tensors. So if I have G and H, and so I1, I2, IS, and are the labels of the shared wires. And the rest of those wires labels are there are private wires. Then after the contraction, all those shared labels are gone. I only have those distinct private labels left. And the corresponding complex number for the indices of those surviving wires is the sum or the product of these two tensors when the shared labels take the same value, and sum over all the values of those shared values. So it's complete analogy of matrix multiplication. So tensor contraction has been used to simulate quantum circuits for a long time. So here's the general framework of doing that. So given a quantum circuit, we are going to consider each gate as a tensor and fix some initial input state. Let's call it, let's say it's a product or zero state. And those states correspond to tensors two. So to simulate the computation, we attach the tensor for the input states to the input wires. And we attach
the tensor for the measurement element to the output wires. And suppose we're interested in measuring, say, this, we're interested in finding out what's the probability of outputting zero. If you measure this qubit, then you attach the tensor for this operator, and you attach the tensor for chasing out, the chase out tensor to those other wires. And you now there's no open wire. Every wire is connected to, is incident to some tensor. And you can check the whole thing, and it's going to give you one single tensor with any wire. And there's a number there. That number is precisely the probability of uploading zero if you start with this thing and applying this circuit. So the conjecture process is determined by an ordering of the edges. You can, the advantage of doing this is, the advantage of doing this compared with the straightforward simulation that you apply each gate sequentially is that you can select which wire to conject first. And you can do some partial matrix multiplication. So for example, you may contract this wire first, and then somewhere in the middle next. And the complexity of the algorithm is determined by the sequence of the contraction. So and for each contraction, you simply write down the multi-dimensional array of the new tensor. Right? And so how many entries you need to write down, that depends on how many wires is incident to the new tensor. And and the number is exponential to the number of wires. So the time is exponential, and also space is exponential in the maximum degree of the new vertex you get in this contraction process. Because this is the number of entries you need to write down for the tensor. So if you want to optimize the algorithm, then you want to minimize this maximum degree. So we, Markov and I define a notion of contraction complexity. So now we can forget about quantum computation. Just look at, we can just focus on the circuit graph. And we want to find out what is the optimum way of contracting this graph so that the maximum degree is minimized. So let's call that contraction complexity of this graph. So it turns out that this contraction complexity of the graph is identical to the tree width of the line graph. So what is a line graph? If you have a graph like this, the line graph is a graph whose vertices are precisely edges of the original graph. And two vertices are connected if the corresponding edges, they are incident to the same vertex in the original graph. So it turns out that the contraction complexity of a graph G is identical to the tree width of the line graph G star. And so what does it help? How does it help us? It helps us. So now we know that if, so for a quantum circuit, we know that we require that every gate applies to a constant number of qubits. So it's a constant degree graph. So for a constant degree graph, the tree width of the graph and the tree width of the line graph are related. So this observation helps us in concluding that if the circuit graph has small tree width, then it's easy to simulate. But let me explain what is a tree width, your third sleeping pill. Before giving you the heavy dose, so here's a, let me start with something lighter. So tree width is a parameter of graph that describes how much a tree, a graph is like a tree. So if G is a tree itself, then tree width is one. And if G is a series parallel graph, something like this, you have something like this, you can, the graph that you can get by composing the sequence of graph and splitting the edges, you know, adding, inserting vertices to edges, and those kind of graphs you get. They're called series parallel. So any of this kind of graph has two width and multitude. And I think it's different. And if G is fully connected, then two width is maximum, is the number of vertices minus one. And two width is a monotone property with respect to taking minor. So if G prime is a minor of G, in other words, if G prime can be obtained from a subgraph of G through edge contraction, then the true width of G prime cannot be larger than true width of G. So this is useful for proving a lower bound of a true width. So if you can find a minor of G that has a large true width, then you prove that G has a large true width. Now, this is heavy dose. What is the true width? So let me start with the notion of tree decomposition. So let's fix a graph G. An example is here. So a tree decomposition of the graph G is a tree T, which is the So in this second graph that I drew, the big circles represent one vertex in a tree. So the big circles, they form a tree. So a tree decomposition is a tree, like this this big tree, together with a function that maps each vertex of the original graph to a vertex. It maps a vertex of the first graph to a subset of the vertices of the second one. Okay. In other words, each vertex in a tree will contain, you can think about each vertex of a tree, will contain a copy of some vertices of the original graph. And this mapping, this way of placing a replicate of a vertex in a vertex of this tree must satisfy the following three conditions. So the first one says that any vertex of the first graph must be placed in some vertex of the tree. Okay, so for obvious reason, each vertex of the tree is called a bag. So every vertex of the first tree of the first graph has to be in some bag. And the second condition says that for any edge of the graph G, there must exist a bag that contains both n vertices of that edge. So every edge is covered by some bag. And the third condition is the most critical one. It says that if you look at the vertices that contain the same the bags that contain the same vertex, say A, we focus on vertex A. You look at all the bags that contain A. So this one, this one, this one, this one. So then those vertices must form a connected subgraph. Must be a connected subtree, and that's the critical property that become useful. That makes tree width become useful. So the width of a tree decomposition is the maximum size of a bag minus one, okay, for some technical reason. And the tree width of the graph tree is the minimum width over all tree decompositions. I close to making it's the sleeping view making factor. Okay, now I have defined what is tree width, and so earlier we observed that we can simulate a quantum circuit. So we relate the complexity simulation of quantum circuit to the tree width of its line graph. So what about the relationship between the tree width of the graph and its line, that of its line graph? So here's a trivial relationship. The trivial of a line graph is at least about half of the trivial of a graph. And at most, the maximum degree of the graph times the trivial of the graph. Okay. So this bound is good when the maximum degree is small, but it's very bad when the maximum degree is large. I mean, it could also be tight in general. So for example, if the graph is a tree with a high degree vertex, then you can avoid, then the line graph has a clique, has a big clique. So this bond is basically tight too. But this bond, which is tight in general, gives us a very bad bond when we want to simulate one-way computation on very much tree-like graph states. So okay, let's come back to simulation of one-way computation and see why that's a problem. So now, recall that one-way computation, we start with a state. Now, I insist that this is a graph state for some graph G. So here's a very straightforward, naive way to simulate the quantum computation, one-way quantum computation. You start with the circuit that generate this, the graph state. So we fix G, and we fix the circuit for generating the graph state. Okay. And so now we look at one way. So I'm going to simulate. I'm a classical computer. I'm going to simulate the one-way computation. And look at what is the next qubit to be measured. And so it's this qubit. Then I attach the corresponding measurement element that correspond to, say, alpha of zero, so M zero. I attach this measurement element to this wire. And I can check the tensor to find out what's the probability of operating zero. Okay. Then after I get T zero, which is probability of the first measurement giving you zero, I toss a coin with the same probability distribution. And I look at a common outcome, which is called B1. I get B1, and then I attach the corresponding measurement element to B1. I revise the measurement element. So earlier I attached M0, now I attach whatever MB1 to that qubit being measured. And then I repeat, I look at, oh, what is the next qubit to be measured? And I attach the corresponding M0 to that qubit, and I can check tensor, and that give me the probability of outputting B1 and 0. And because I also remember, also write down what is B1. So once I know B1, the chance of operating B1 and the chance of operating B1 and 0, then I know what's the conditional probability. Now I will output 0. So I toss another coin with the same conditional probability. And then I check the one-way computation and see what's the next qubit to be measured, and repeat the same thing. So every time when I need to compute a probability, I'm doing a tensor contraction. And all those tensor contractions, they have the same complexity, because what I'm doing is just attaching a degree one vertex to an open wire in a graph. It doesn't affect the contraction complexity. So so now the key question is, what is the complexity of contracting a circuit that produces the graph state? So so once we fix a circuit CG that produces the graph state, and we know that the contraction can be done in exponential time of the contraction complexity of the circuit graph, and we know this is precisely the true width of the line graph, right? And by our bond that true width of the graph is no more than okay, so we know that the true width of the line graph this normal and maximum degree of g times trivials of g, then this can be done in exponential time of the maximum degree of g times the trivials of g. So that's what we can get from earlier work. As I said, this is very bad. When the graph g is this graph, that gives us very bad bound. But we know, intuitively we feel that if graph is a tree, then it should be easy to simulate. Okay, so the way to moderate this bond is we look at an expansion before we do contraction. We do expansion, philosophical approach. So we expand, so for example, we could expand this vertex into a sequence of vertices. And now we get a tree with a constant degree, a constant maximum degree. Okay. Now, the one-way simulation, this bond becomes good, right, because the maximum degree now is constant. And the reason why we can do expansion before we do construction, because there's a way to go from the graph state here to the graph state here. And if you, not precisely, if you could add, so if you add insert a single vertex on those edges, then the corresponding graph state can produce this state through a one-way computation. Okay, so that's why we can do expansion and then do contraction. So what is a graph expansion? So let me formally define that. Suppose V is a vertex in this graph. Then by splitting this vertex, I mean I'm going to replace V by V1 and V2. And I will connect neighbors of V to either V1 or V2, and also connect V1 and V2. In other words, if you contract this edge, it will go back to the original graph. And we define the expansion. An expansion of a graph G is a graph that you get from G by doing a sequence of vertex split. And let me just repeat what I described earlier, and I believe this is first observed by in your paper, Rosendorf and Brigio, that if you have a graph G prime, which is an expansion of a graph G, and you, from G prime you get G double prime by inserting a single qubit, inserting a vertex on some edges of G. Then you can convert the graph state G double prime to G through a one-way quantum computation. So therefore, if you have a T-step one-way computation on G, then you can do the same thing by starting with G double prime, and then through one-way computation, you produce G, and then you continue on the computation. Okay. So now the new one-way computation start with the graph G double prime and achieves the same result as the original one-way computation. And by earlier result, this can be simulated in expression time of the maximum degree of G double prime and the trivial of G double prime. So now the question is, how can we expand G so that the maximum degree of G double prime is minimal? Is no more than 3, and the two ways of G double prime is about the same. It doesn't grow too much. Okay, that's the main technical question we considered. So before I jump to our conclusion, so I want to give you an example that when you're doing expansion, if you're not careful, you could blow up the two ways dramatically. So let's look at this example that we have look at before. This is a series of parallel graph. So this graph, no matter how many parallel edges you have, say d of them, no matter how big d is, and no matter how long this sequence is, the trivial is no more than 2. And there exists a good expansion. So you can expand this graph to this graph, where each you have a latent this box becomes this, and all those different layers of latents are connected by an edge. And this is still a series parallel graph, so chip is still small. And it's constant degree graph. But if you're not careful enough, you may get a grid. So this graph, you can also expand to get this graph, which contains a grid mark. So therefore, if you're not careful enough, the blow up in chipways could be arbitrary graph. So therefore, it's not true that any expansion is good. So our maintaining result is, for any graph G, there exists an expansion G prime, so that the maximum degree of G prime is 3, and the tree width is at most the original tree width plus 1. This is almost as good as it could be. And you may be annoyed by this plus 1, but it turns out that this plus 1 is necessary. So we're able to find a family of graphs so that actually any constant degree expansion has to have one more in tree width. So now I'm going to construct this expansion. So we fix a graph G, and we fix a tree decomposition T. And the first thing I'm going to do is I look at each bag of the tree decomposition, and I want to make sure that inside the bag, each vertex has a small number of neighbors in the same bag. And this can be easily accomplished. So if in the bag there's a vertex V that has, say, more than 3 neighbors, I will split the vertex V to V1 and V2. And basically, I will split this to V1 and V2. So it becomes V1 and V2. I insert a new vertex, V2 on this edge, and I will U is not a neighbor of V anymore, and I can add a new bag that contains V1, V2, and U, and now I reduce the degree of V1 inside like that. So this is a very relatively simple thing to do. So now we can assume that inside each bag, each vertex has a small number of neighbors. Has at most 2 neighbors. Okay, so maybe this is your, this is your 4th sleeping view. I make it colorful. Now, I want to construct this new an expansion of the graph, so it has a small maximum degree and does not increase in tree width. So look at our example, and now let's focus on the vertex A here. So I look at each bag. So for example, let's focus on this bag, and I focus on the vertex A. I'm going to duplicate A many times. So think about A as Agent Smith. Now it's copying itself. So this agent Smith A, we're going to have A00 and A01. So for each bag, okay. So now this is the first bag, and I look at all the adjacent bags. Bag 1, bag 2, bag 3, bag 4, bag 5. Those are the bags adjacent to bag 0. So I will have a clone of vertex A that correspond to each neighboring bags. So first I will have a master agent Smith, which is A00. Okay. And then for each neighboring bag, I will have a clone agent Smith, which is say A01 is the clone for corresponding to back one, and A02 is a clone for the back two, and A03 is the clone for back three, and so on and so forth. And I connect all those agent SMEs together. So I have a path graph connecting those new vertices. And I do it for all the vertices inside the back B0. Okay, so you will see this parallel path graph. I didn't draw all the edges here. So and those are my vertices. So I finished describing the vertices. Okay. So I need to add edges. I already described some edges. Those are the edges connecting the agent SMEs of the same vertex. Now, there are two types of edges. So if a vertex appears in two backs, so for example here, the vertex A appears in both vertex back 0 and back 5. Okay. So therefore there are two strings of clones of agent SMEs in parallel universe. So I'm going to connect those parallel universes. So I will connect A05 and A50 by an edge. Okay, so connecting those parallel universe agent SMEs. Okay, and the second type of edges I would add is so inside the same bag, so if A, so you see inside bag 0, so A and D, they are connected. Okay. And I'm going to connect the agent SMEs of A and agent SMEs of D, the master agent SMEs of those two strings by an edge. So those master agent SMEs, they are A00 and D00, right? And I connect them use one edge. Okay, and I finish the construction of the graph. So now let's see why this graph has small maximum degree. So for every vertex, if they say master agent SMEs, then is connected in his own strand of agent SMEs, right? A00 is connected to A01. And at the same time, it may be connected to two other agent SMEs corresponding to, say, vertex B and vertex B. Okay. But we know that within each bag, the maximum degree is at most two. So therefore, each master agent SME is connected to at most three. For instance, now for a land master agent SMEs is connected to his father and his parent and his parent agent SMEs and his offspring agent SMEs, and it may also be connected to a parallel universe agent SMEs, but it has almost, so altogether almost three neighbors. So the graph I constructed has maximum degree almost three. Okay, and we can verify that this is a tree decomposition, and I'm going to skip that part because that's a really effective CDMA appeal, and I don't want to use this. Okay, so now I'm going to focus on. I also need to argue that this is expansion of the original graph, and the reason is because, each vertex inside a bag is expanded to a path graph, and we connect those path graphs corresponding to the same vertex by one edge, which is the ladder between parallel universes. So each vertex is now replaced by a tree. Okay. And between different trees, corresponding to different vertices, we have one edge if the two vertices are connected in G, and no edge if they are not connected. So therefore, if you contract all the edges of the tree that correspond to a vertex, then that goes back to your original vertex, and you don't create duplicating edges. And this is another way to say that the graphic construction is an expansion of the rejection bar. So this is something that you can check. Yeah. So I need to make sure that the two ways is small. So now I need to construct the bags. And actually, I already drew the bags. The bags are the following. So there are three types of bags. The first type of bags contains the monster agent smith. Okay. So this bag correspond to this bag will contain all the monster agent smiths for the vertex ABC, ABCD, appear in the original bag zero. And here is another monster bag that contains the monster agent smiths that appear in another bag in the original tree decomposition. And then we have, okay, it's too much. Yeah. And then we have the second type is we have bags that contain the clones of the agent smiths that correspond to the same neighboring bags of the original tree decomposition. So this is the first generation of agent smiths produced from bag zero, and they are grouped together in a new bag. And this is the second generation of agent smiths. They are grouped in the same bag. Okay. So because we start with, so okay, therefore every bag has no, the size of the bag are the same. They cannot be more than the size of the original bag. Okay. Now, after those two type of bags, there are some edges we have not covered. So for example, those edges that link a father agent smith to a children of agent smiths, they are not covered. And also those parallel universe letters, they are not covered. Okay. And we are going to create a chain of bags to cover those edges. So basically we have the situation like this. We have a bag A and a bag B. They share some common vertices, but they also have some vertices that are disjoint, and there are edges. There are edges between those distinct vertices that we hope to cover. So what do? We just create a chain of bags and gradually replace each red dot by a green dot. And so for example, in this first bag, I will have a green dot to cover the edge between this vertex and this, between these two vertices. And then for the next bag, I will kick this guy out, and then I'll introduce this new green vertex to cover the next edge. So we can do this, and at a cost of increasing the size of the bag by one. And this is where the plus one comes from. Okay, so I finished constructing the tree decomposition. You can verify this is indeed a valid tree decomposition. So okay, I'm going to give you the example. Okay, maybe if you're interested, you can ask me for the example. Let me jump to the open problem. And of course, the conclusion is, what you believe a fork law is indeed true. Let me jump to the open problem. So which states are universal for measurement-based computation? So I'm going to risk criticism by defining a strong notion of universality. So we know that actually by work of Gross and Essert, we know there are states that are universal, but they are not the graph states. So I feel that there must be a simple, beautiful characterization of universal source for measurement-based computation, and it's there waiting for us to discover. But we need to define what we want to discover first. We want to avoid having to solve a question: is quantum computation more powerful than classical? So I'm going to define a family of n-qubit state universal. If for any circuit of size m, there exists a measurement-based quantum computation on Sn for some n of polynomial size in m, such that this measurement-based computation produce precisely the same final state of the circuit. Okay, this is a very strong notion. You may relax it, but I hope to make it strong so that we can prove. So that we can prove that some states are non-universal without showing that no classical computation can do this task. That's very difficult. And I feel that there could be very simple precision of what is universal under this definition. And since I'm a computer scientist, let me give you a computer science question. The second question is, can we simulate quantum communication better than what is best known now? So in other words, what is the best classical upper bound of BQP? So another incrementalist approach is to start with very powerful classical computation that can simulate quantum computation, and then gradually limit the power of classical computation. So in particular, can you reduce a problem that can be solved by solved efficiently by quantum computation to a problem that has a flavor of satisfiability? This new problem is, so you have a formula phi of variables, and you're asking if there exists x1, x2, so that for any y1, y2, yn, and there exists y3, z1, z2, blah, blah. And there are some constant number of alternations in those quantifiers. So if there's only one quantifier, say existence, then it's satisfiability. So now let's say, how about constant layer? It's more powerful. Can you reduce a quantum solvable problem to such a problem? So that's what I consider is the most important problem, solvable problem in understanding the complexity of quantum computation. Great, thank you very much.
We have time for one or two quick questions.
Yes. This notion of, you're using tree width, branch width is very, very similar to tree width that's within a background too. So so effectively it would be a good view.
Right.
And this result that says that every graph of tree width K is a minor of a cubic graph of tree width K plus one. Branch width, you don't have to pass one, and you have a very simple proof. So I'm just suggesting that maybe you should think of using branch width there.
And that the corresponding statement is non-result.
It's not now. But it's really quite straightforward.
Okay. Branch width. All right. Okay. Branch.
So, and you don't have to pass one.
If you have a times two.
Yeah.
If you want to relate it to tree with you, if you state it in terms of branch with you,
either way, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Why stop at a constant number of alternations?
You can do logarithmic. You can start with logarithmic. If you have unbounded number of alternations, I mean finite number of alternations, you get p space, which you know.
I have a question. So do you have a reason to think it might be that you cost a number of alternations?
I don't have any reason to think it's that.
Because bursting Vajrani sounds like maybe you need logarithmic at least.
But I don't see that as evidence of the negative.
So if there are no more questions, let's thank you again.
Thank you.